was a loud bang. Once, twice. A few seconds later came the whistling and explosions, so many and so close together that you couldn't count them. Leonard was standing closest to the window, so he was the one who exclaimed, "Look, fireworks!" Jim had sent a young officer from the station to buy them. He was setting them off from down by the bridge. Leonard, Zara, Julia, Roe, Annalena, Roger, and the real estate agent went out onto the balcony. They stood there watching in amazement. They weren't pathetic little bangers, either. They were the real thing. Different colors, the sort that looked like rain, the whole deal. Because, as luck would have it, Jim liked fireworks, too. The bank robber and Estelle watched them from the kitchen window, arm in arm.
"Knut would have liked this," Estelle nodded.
"I hope you like it, too," the bank robber managed to say.
"Very much, you sweet child. Very much indeed. Thank you."
"I'm so sorry for everything I've done to you all," the bank robber sniffed. Estelle pouted her lips unhappily.
"Perhaps we could explain everything to the police. Tell them it was all a mistake?"
"No, I don't think so."
"Perhaps you could escape somehow? Hide somewhere?"
Estelle smelled of wine. Her pupils were ever so slightly unfocused. The bank robber was about to reply, then realized that the less Estelle knew, the better. Then the old woman wouldn't have to lie for the bank robber's sake when she was questioned by the police. So she said, "No, I don't think that would work." Estelle held her hand. There wasn't much else she could do. The fireworks were beautiful. Knut would have loved them. When they were finished, the bank robber went into the living room and the others all came back in from the balcony. The bank robber tried to signal discreetly that she wanted to talk to the real estate agent, but sadly that was impossible given that the real estate agent was busy arguing with Roger about the price Julia and Roe ought to pay for the apartment if they bought it.
"Okay then, okay,"
the real estate agent finally snapped. "I can go a bit lower, but only because I have to put the other apartment up for sale in 2 weeks' time, and I don't want that competing with this one." Roger, Julia, and Roe all tilted their heads in such a way that they bumped into one another.
"Which other apartment?" Roger asked.
The real estate agent harrumphed, annoyed with herself for having let that slip out.
"The apartment opposite, on the other side of the elevator. I haven't even put it up on my website yet, because if you sell two apartments at the same time, you get less for both. All good real estate agents know that. The other apartment looks just the same as this one, only with a slightly smaller closet. But for some reason, it has excellent mobile reception, and that seems to be ridiculously important for people these days. The couple who own it are splitting up. They had a terrible row in my office. They've removed all the furniture from the apartment. The only thing left in there is a juicer. And I can quite see why neither of them would want it, because it's a truly terrible color."
The real estate agent went on babbling for a long time, but no one was really listening anymore. Roger and Julia looked at each other, then at the bank robber, then at the real estate agent.
"Hang on. You're saying you're going to be selling the neighboring apartment as well? The one on the other side of the elevator? And there's no one living there at the moment?"
Julia asked, just to be sure. The real estate agent stopped babbling and started to nod instead. Julia looked at the bank robber, and of course they were both thinking exactly the same thing, a possible solution to all this.
"Have you got the keys to the other apartment?" Julia asked with a hopeful smile,
convinced that this would be a perfect end to the whole thing. Unfortunately, the real estate agent looked back at Julia as if that were a ridiculous question.
"Why would I? I'm not even going to start trying to sell it for another 2 weeks. And do you think I carry people's keys around just for the fun of it? What sort of real estate agent do you take me for?"
Roger sighed. Julia sighed, more deeply. The bank robber wasn't even breathing, just tumbling headlong into the hopelessness inside her.
"I had an affair once,"
Estelle said cheerfully from the other end of the apartment, because she'd found another bottle of wine in the kitchen.
"Not now, Estelle,"
Julia said, but the old woman was insistent. She was slightly drunk, that can't be denied, because the closet had already provided quite a lot of wine for an elderly lady.
I had an affair once, she repeated, with her eyes fixed on the bank robbers. And the bank robber suddenly felt nervous about the possible details that might slip out in a story that started like that. Estelle waved the wine bottle and went on.
He loved books, and so did I, but my husband didn't. Knut liked music. I suppose music's all right, but it's not the same, is it?
The bank robber shook her head politely.
No, I like books too.
I thought as much from looking at you. As if you understand that people need fairy tales as well, not just narrative. I've liked you from the moment you came in here, you know. You messed things up a bit with the pistol and all that, but who hasn't messed things up at one time or another? All interesting people have done something really stupid at least once. For instance, I had an affair behind Knut's back with a man who loved books just like me. Whenever I read anything now, I think of the pair of them, because he gave me a key, and I never told Knut that I kept it.
Please, Estelle, we're trying to, Julia said, but Estelle ignored her. She ran one hand along the bookcase. One of the last times she met her neighbor in the elevator, he gave her a very thick book written by a man. He had underlined one sentence several hundred pages in. We are asleep until we fall in love. Estelle gave him a book in exchange, one written by a woman, so it didn't need hundreds of pages to say things. Close to the start, Estelle had underlined, love is wanting you to exist. Her fingers traced the spines of the books on the shelf as if she were dreaming, not as if she were looking. A book fell out from the middle of a row, not as if it had done so on purpose, but simply because her fingernails happened to touch its spine. It landed on the floor and fell open a few pages in. The key that fell out bounced off the pages, then landed on the parquet floor with a tinkling sound. Estelle's chest was rising and falling breathlessly, and her voice may have been slurred, but her eyes were crystal clear when she said,
When Knut fell ill, we signed the apartment over to our daughter. I thought she might want to move in here with her children, but that was obviously a silly idea. They didn't want to live here. They've got their own lives in a place of their own. Since then, there's only been me here, and, well, you can see, it's too big for me. This isn't a sensible apartment for a single person. So in the end, my daughter said we ought to sell it and buy something smaller for me, something easier to look after, she said. So I called several different real estate agents, and obviously they all said that it wasn't usual to hold a viewing so close to New Year, but I wanted, well, I thought it would be nice to have a bit of company at this time of year. So I went out before the real estate agent arrived. Then I came back up once the viewing had started and pretended to be a prospective buyer, because I didn't want to sell the apartment without knowing who was going to be buying it. This isn't just an apartment. It's my home. I don't want to hand it over to someone who's just going to be passing through to make money from it. I want someone who's going to love living here, like I have. Maybe that's hard for a young person to understand.
That wasn't true. There wasn't a single person in the apartment who didn't understand perfectly. But the real estate agent cleared her throat.
So, when your daughter commissioned me, I wasn't the first person she'd called?
Oh, no. She called all the other real estate agents before she felt obliged to ring you. But just look how it's all turned out, Estelle smiled.
The real estate agent brushed the dust off her jacket and her ego.
So this is the key to,
the bank robber began, staring at it but still not quite able to believe it. Estelle nodded.
My affair. He lived in the neighboring apartment on the other side of the elevator. That's where he died. I was standing in front of the bookcase when the apartment was put up for sale, and I wondered what would have happened if I'd met him first, before Knut. You can let yourself do that when you get old. Go for a little stroll in your imagination. A young couple bought the apartment. They never changed the lock.
Julia cleared her throat, rather taken aback.
Sorry, Estelle, but how do you know that?
Estelle gave her an embarrassed little smile.
Every so often, Well, I've never actually opened the door, of course. I'm not a criminal, but Sometimes I check to see if the key still fits. It does.
It doesn't surprise me that they're splitting up, that young couple. It really doesn't, because I often used to hear them arguing when I was smoking in the closet. The walls are rather thin in there. You get to hear all sorts of things. Some of it would shock even Stockholmers, I can tell you.
The bank robber put the book back on the shelf, clutched the key tightly. Then she turned to the others and whispered, I don't know what to say.
Don't say anything at all. Go and hide in the other apartment until this is all over. Then you can go home to your daughters, Estelle said.
The key was dancing in the bank robber's palm when she unclenched her fist. She couldn't hold it still.
I haven't got a home to go back to. I can't pay the rent. And I can't ask any of you to lie for my sake when you talk to the police. They're going to ask who I am and if you know where I'm hiding, and I don't want you to lie for me.
Of course we're going to lie for you, Roe exclaimed.
Don't worry about us, Julia cajoled.
We don't actually have to lie, any of us, Roger said. We just need to play dumb.
Yes, well, there's no problem then, is there? Because that's hardly going to be a challenge for any of you, Zara declared.
For once, it wasn't actually meant as an insult. It just sounded like it.
Annalena nodded thoughtfully at the bank robber.
Roger's right. We just have to play dumb. We can say you never took the mask off, so we can't give a description.
The bank robber tried to protest. They didn't give her a chance. Then there was a knock at the door, and Roger went into the hall and peered through the spy hole and saw Jim standing outside. That was when Roger realized what the real problem was.
Damn! That policeman's out in the stairwell. How are you going to get past him into the other apartment without him seeing you? We didn't think of that, he exclaimed.
Perhaps we could distract him, Julia suggested.
I could squirt lime juice in his eyes, Roe nodded.
Perhaps we could just try reasoning with him, Estelle said hopefully.
Unless we all run out at once so he gets confused, Annalena said, thinking out loud.
Naked! People always get more confused when you're naked,
Leonard informed them in his capacity as an expert.
Zara was standing next to him, and he was probably expecting her to tell him he was a damn idiot, but instead she said,
Perhaps we could bribe him, the policeman. Most men can be bought.
Leonard, of course, noticed that she could have said most people. She didn't have to say most men. But he couldn't help thinking it was a nice gesture on her part to try to be part of the group. The bank robber stood in front of them for a long while with the key in her hand, on the brink of telling them about Jim, but instead she said thoughtfully,
No. If I tell you how I'm going to escape, you'd have to lie when the police question you. But if you just walk out of here now and go downstairs, you can tell the truth. When you closed the door behind you, I was still in here. You don't know what happened to me after that.
They looked like they wanted to protest, all except Zara, but eventually nodded in response, even Zara. Estelle put some cling wrap over the remains of the pizza and put it in the fridge. She wrote her phone number on a scrap of paper, put it in the bank robber's pocket, and whispered,
Send me a text when you're safe. Otherwise, I'll worry.
The bank robber promised. Then all the hostages walked out of the apartment. Roger went last and carefully closed the door behind him until he heard the latch click. Jim directed them to walk down the stairs, where Jack was waiting to escort them into the police cars that would drive them to the station to be questioned. Jim was left alone in the stairwell for a while and waited until Jack came up the stairs.
Is the bank robber still in there now? Are you sure, Dad? Jack asked.
100%, Jim said.
Good. The negotiator's going to call the phone in there shortly and try to get him to come out voluntarily. Otherwise, we'll have to break the door in.
Jim nodded. Jack looked around, then crouched down by the elevator and picked up a piece of paper.
What's this?
Looks like a drawing,
Jim said. Jack put it in his pocket, looked at the time. The negotiator made the call. It had been tucked inside one of the pizza boxes, the special telephone thingy. It was Ro who had found it. She was very hungry, so she just thought it was odd to find a phone in a pizza box, put it down, and decided to eat first before bothering to think about it. And by the time she'd finished eating, she'd forgotten all about it. There was so much else going on, the fireworks and all the rest of it, and perhaps you had to know Ro to understand just how absent-minded she could be. But perhaps it's enough to know that once she'd finished her own pizza, she opened all the other boxes and ate the crusts the others had left. At that point, Roger turned to her and said she needn't worry. He was sure she was going to be a good parent now, because good parents eat other people's crusts out of other people's boxes, just like that. Hearing that meant so much to Ro that she burst into tears. So the phone was left on the little three-legged table beside the sofa, as unsteady as a spider on an ice cube. When all the hostages had gone, the bank robber put her pistol down next to the phone, after wiping it carefully first, of course, because Roger had seen a documentary about how the police find fingerprints at crime scenes. She also threw her ski mask on the fire, because Roger had said the cops might be able to get DNA and all sorts of other stuff off it otherwise. Then the bank robber went out through the door. Jim was standing alone on the landing. They glanced at each other quickly, she gratefully, he full of stress. She showed him the key. He breathed out. "Hurry up," he said. "I just want to say, I haven't told anyone you're doing this for me. I didn't want anyone to have to lie for me when they were questioned," she said. "Good," he nodded. She tried in vain to blink away the dampness in her eyes, because of course she knew she was actually asking someone to lie for her, more than he had ever lied for anyone. But Jim wouldn't let her apologize, just pushed her past the elevator door and whispered, "Good luck." She went inside the neighboring apartment and locked the door behind her. Jim was left standing on his own in the stairwell for a minute, which gave him time to think of his wife and hope she was proud of him. Or at least, not really angry. With all the hostages safely on their way to the station, Jack came running up the stairs. Then the negotiator made the call, and the pistol hit the floor. Chapter 67. Back in the police station, Jim has told Jack the truth. The whole truth. His son wants to be angry. He wishes he had the time. But because he's a good son, he's busy trying to come up with a plan instead. Once they've let the witnesses leave through the back door of the police station, he sets off toward the main entrance at the front. "You don't have to do this, son. I can go," Jim says disconsolately. He stops himself from saying, "Sorry I lied to you, but deep down you know I did the right thing." Jack shakes his head firmly. "No, Dad. Stay here." He stops himself from saying, "You've caused enough problems." Then he walks out onto the steps at the front of the building and tells the waiting reporters everything they need to know. That Jack himself has been responsible for the whole of the police response and that they have lost the perpetrator. That no one knows where he is now. Some of the journalists start shouting accusing questions about police incompetence. Others merely smirk as they take notes, ready to slaughter Jack in articles and blog posts a few hours from now. The shame and failure are Jack's alone. He carries them on his own so that no one else gets blamed. Inside the station, his dad sits with his face in his hands. The detectives from Stockholm arrive early the next morning, New Year's Eve. They read through all the witness statements, talk to Jack and Jim, check all the evidence. And then the Stockholmers snort, in voices more self-important than adverts for dishwashing liquid, that they really don't have the resources to do more than that. No one was hurt during the hostage drama, nothing was stolen in the robbery, so there aren't really any victims here. The Stockholmers need to focus their resources where they're really needed. Besides, it's New Year's Eve, and who wants to celebrate in a town as small as this? They're going to be in a hurry to get home, and Jack and Jim will watch them drive off. The journalists will already have disappeared by then, on their way to the next big story. There's always another celebrity who might be on the point of getting divorced.
You're a good police officer, son, Jim will say, looking down at the ground.
He'll want to add, but an even better person, but won't be able to bring himself to say it.
You're not always such a damn good police officer, Dad.
Jack will grin up at the clouds.
He'll want to add, but I've learned everything else from you.
But the words won't quite come out. They'll go home, watch television, have a beer together. That's enough. Chapter 68. On the steps at the back of the police station, Estelle hugs each of them in turn. Except Zara, of course, who blocks her with her handbag and jumps out of the way when she tries.
I have to say, if you have to be held hostage, then there's no better company to be in than all of you.
Estelle smiles at them all.
Even Zara.
Would you like to come and have coffee with us? Julia asks.
No, I need to get home.
Estelle smiles. Then she suddenly becomes serious and turns to the real estate agent.
I really am very sorry I changed my mind and didn't let you sell the apartment after all. But it's home.
The real estate agent shrugs.
I think that's rather lovely, actually. People always think real estate agents just want to sell, but there's something, I don't quite know how to say it.
Leonard fills in with the words she can't find.
There's something romantic about the thought of all the apartments that aren't for sale.
The real estate agent nods. Estelle takes several deep, happy breaths. She's going to be neighbors with Julia and Ro in the apartment on the other side of the landing, and she and Julia will be able to swap books in the elevator. The first one Estelle is going to give her is by her favorite poet. She'll fold down the corner of one page, underline some of the finest words she knows.
Nothing must happen to you. No, what am I saying? Everything must happen to you. And it must be wonderful.
Julia will give Estelle a completely different type of literature in exchange. A guidebook about Stockholm. Ro will lose her dad. She'll visit him every week. He's still on Earth, but already belongs to heaven. Ro's mom will find the strength to cope with the loss because another man will show her that life goes on. Julia will give birth to him with her hand clasped so tightly around Ro's fingers that the nurses have to give both mothers painkillers, one before the birth, the other after. Ro will sleep beside him, perfectly still, on white sheets, without feeling afraid, because she would have crossed mountains for his sake, would have done anything. Robbed banks, if necessary. They're going to be good parents, Ro and Julia. Good enough, anyway. Julia will still hide candies, and Ro will be allowed to keep her birds. The monkey and the frog will love them, visit them every day, and even when Julia offers them lots of money, they won't leave the cage open. Julia and Ro will argue, then make up, and all you have to do is make sure you're better at the latter than the former. So they will shout loudly and laugh even louder. And when they make up, the walls will shake and Estelle will feel embarrassed in her closet. Their love will continue to be a flower shop. Outside the police station, Zara skips quickly down the steps to the street, afraid that someone else might try to hug her. Leonard hurries after her.
Would you like to share a taxi?
He asks. As if that weren't the very definition of anarchy. Zara looks like she's never shared a taxi in her life, or anything else, for a very long time. But after a long pause, she mutters,
If we do, you can sit in the front. And we're not going in a car with lots of crap dangling from the rearview mirror. That's an evolutionary dead end.
Anna Lena is still sitting on the steps. Roger sits down beside her with an effort. Just close enough that they're almost touching. Annalena stretches out her fingers toward his. She wants to say sorry. So does he. It's a harder word than you might think when you've been climbing trees for so long. She looks up at the sky, dark now. December is merciless. But she knows that IKEA is still open. A light out there somewhere.
We could go and look at that countertop you were talking about, she whispers.
She crumbles when he shakes his head. Roger says nothing for a long time. He keeps changing his mind.
I thought perhaps we could do something else, he eventually mumbles.
What do you mean?
The cinema. Maybe. If you'd like that.
It's a good thing Anna Lena is already sitting down, because otherwise she would have had to. They go and see something made up, because people need stories, too, sometimes. In the darkness of the auditorium, they hold hands. For Anna Lena, it feels like coming home, and for Roger, like being good enough. Estelle hurries back to her apartment. On the way, she calls her daughter and tells her not to worry, either about the hostage drama or the fact that her mom lives alone in that large apartment. Because she doesn't anymore. Estelle will have to give up smoking, because the young woman who's going to be renting a room in the apartment won't even let her smoke in the closet. If we're being pedantic, the young woman actually rents the whole apartment from Estelle's daughter, and then Estelle rents a room from her for the same amount. $6,500. On the door of the fridge hangs a crumpled drawing of a monkey and a frog and an elk. Estelle stole it from the interview room when Jim was getting coffee. Each morning, every other week, the monkey and the frog will eat breakfast with their mom in Estelle's kitchen. For many years, on the last night of the year, they will watch fireworks together from the window. Then, eventually, a night will come which will be Estelle's last night without Knut, and everyone else's last night with Estelle. At her funeral, Ro will suggest an inscription for her headstone. Here lies Estelle. She certainly liked her wine. Julia will kick Ro on the shin, but not hard. Their son will hold each of them by the hand as they walk away. Julia keeps the old woman's books for the rest of her life. The wine bottles, too. When the monkey and the frog grow into teenagers, they smoke in secret in the closet. Somewhere in some sort of heaven, Estelle will be listening to music with one man and talking about literature with another. She's earned that. Oh, yes, in the basement storage area of an apartment block not far from there, where a mother of two little girls who became a bank robber once slept, alone and frightened. There's still a box of blankets there the day after the hostage drama. Somewhere else entirely, a bank doesn't get robbed the day after New Year because the person who hid their pistol down there under the blankets turns the whole storage area upside down, shouting and swearing because it's gone. Because what sort of callous bastard would steal a person's pistol? Idiots. Chapter 69. The windowsill outside the office is weighed down by snow. The psychologist is talking to her dad on the phone. Darling Nadia, my little bird, he says in the language of his homeland, because bird is a more beautiful word there.
I love you too, Dad,
Nadia says patiently. He never used to talk to her like that, but late in life, even computer programmers become poets. Nadia assures him over and over that she'll drive carefully when she sets off to visit him the following day, but he'd still prefer to come and fetch her. Dads are dads, and daughters are daughters, and not even psychologists can quite come to terms with that. Nadia hangs up. There's a knock on the door, like when someone who doesn't want to touch the door taps on it with the end of an umbrella. Zara is standing outside. She's holding a letter in her hand.
Hello? Sorry, I thought... Have we got an appointment booked for now?
Nadia wonders, fumbling first for her diary, then for her mobile to see what time it is.
No, I just... Zara replies quietly.
A gentle tremble of the metal spokes of the umbrella gives her away. Nadia spots it.
Come in, come in,
she says anxiously. The skin under Zara's eyes is full of tiny cracks, worn down by everything it's had to hold back, finally on the brink of bursting. She looks at the picture of the woman on the bridge for several minutes before she asks Nadia,
Do you like your job?
Yes, Nadia nods, unsettled.
Are you happy?
Nadia wants to reach out and touch her, but refrains.
Yes, I'm happy, Zara. Not all the time, but I've learned that you don't have to be happy all the time. But I'm happy enough. Is that what you came here to ask?
Zara looks past her.
You asked me once why I like my job, and I said it was because I was good at it. But I unexpectedly found myself with some time to think recently, and I think I liked my job because I believed in it.
How do you mean?
The psychologist asks, in her professional voice, despite the fact that she feels like saying, unprofessionally, that she's really pleased to see Zara, that she's been thinking about her a lot and has been worrying about what she might do. Zara reaches out her hand as close to the picture as possible without actually touching the woman.
I believe in the place of banks in society. I believe in order. I've never had any objection to the fact that our customers and the media and politicians all hate us. That's our purpose. Banks need to be the ballast in the system. They make it slow, bureaucratic, difficult to maneuver, to stop the world lurching about too much. People need bureaucracy to give them time to think before they do something stupid.
She falls silent. The psychologist sits down quietly on her chair.
Forgive me for speculating, Zara, but it sounds like something's changed in you.
Zara looks her straight in the eye then, for the first time.
The housing market is going to crash again. Maybe not tomorrow, but it's going to crash again. We know that. Yet we still lend money. When people lose everything, we tell them it was their responsibility. That those are the rules of the game, that it was their own fault they were so greedy. But of course that isn't true. Most people aren't greedy. Most people are just, like you said when we were talking about the picture, they're just looking for something to cling on to, something to fight for. They want somewhere to live, somewhere to raise their children, live their lives.
Has anything happened to you since we last met?
The psychologist asks. Zara gives her a troubled smile. Because how do you answer that? So instead, she answers a question that's never been asked.
Everything's become lighter, easier, Nadia. The banks aren't ballast anymore. 100 years ago, practically everyone who worked in a bank understood how the bank made money. Now there are at most 3 people in each bank who really understand where it all comes from.
And you're questioning your place there now? Because you no longer think you understand?
The psychologist guesses. Zara's chin moves sadly from side to side.
No. I've handed in my notice, because I realized that I was one of the 3.
What are you going to do from now on?
I don't know.
The psychologist finally has something important to say. Something she didn't learn at college, but knows that everyone needs to hear every so often.
Not knowing is a good place to start.
Zara doesn't say anything more. She massages her hands, counts windows. The desk is narrow. The 2 women probably wouldn't have felt comfortable sitting so close to each other if it hadn't been there between them. Sometimes we don't need distance, just barriers. Zara's movements are wary, Nadia's cautious. Only after a long time has passed does the psychologist venture to speak again.
Do you remember asking me, one of the first times we met, if I could explain what panic attacks were? I don't think I ever gave you a good answer.
Have you got a better one now?
Zara asks. The psychologist shakes her head. Zara can't help smiling. Then Nadia says, as herself, in her own words rather than those of her psychology training or anyone else,
But you know what, Zara? I've learned that it helps to talk about it. Unfortunately, I think most people would still get more sympathy from their colleagues and bosses at work if they show up looking rough one morning and say, "I'm hungover," than if they say, "I'm suffering from anxiety." But I think we pass people in the street every day who feel the same as you and I. Many of them just don't know what it is. Men and women going around for months having trouble breathing and seeing doctor after doctor because they think there's something wrong with their lungs. All because it's so damn difficult to admit that something else is broken. That it's an ache in our soul, invisible lead weights in our blood, and indescribable pressure in our chest. Our brains are lying to us, telling us we're going to die. But there's nothing wrong with our lungs, Zara. We're not going to die, you and I. The words drift around between them, dancing invisibly on their retinas before the silence takes them. We're not going to die. We're not going to die. We're not going to die, you and I.
Yet, Zara eventually points out, and the psychologist bursts out laughing.
Do you know what, Zara? Maybe you could get a new job writing mottos for fortune cookies? She smiles.
The only note a cake eater needs to find is, "This is why you're fat," Zara replies.
Then she laughs too, but the quivering tip of her nose gives her away. Her gaze darts first through the window, then it sneaks back to glance at Nadia's hands, then her neck, then her chin, never quite up to her eyes, but almost. The silence that follows is the longest they've shared. Zara closes her eyes, presses her lips together, and the skin beneath her eyes finally gives way. Her terror forms itself into fragile drops and sets off toward the edge of the desk. Very slowly, she lets the envelope slip out of her hand. The psychologist picks it up hesitantly. Zara wants to whisper that it was because of the letter that she came here that very first time, when exactly 10 years had passed since the man jumped. That she needs someone to read out loud what he wrote to her. And then, when her chest has caught fire, stop her from jumping herself. She wants to whisper the whole thing, about the bridge and about Nadia, and how Zara watched as the boy came running over and saved her. And how she has spent every single day since then thinking about the difference between people. But all she manages to say is, "Nadia, you, I." Nadia feels like embracing the older woman on the other side of the desk, hugging her, but she doesn't dare. So instead, while Zara keeps her eyes closed, the psychologist gently slips her little finger beneath the back of the envelope and opens it. She pulls out a 10-year-old handwritten note. 4 words. Chapter 70. The bridge is covered with ice, sparkling beneath the last few valiant stars as dawn heaves its way over the horizon. The town is breathing deeply around it, still asleep, swaddled in eiderdowns and dreams and tiny feet belonging to hearts our own can't beat without. Zara is standing by the railing. She leans forward, looks over the edge. It almost looks, just for a single, solitary moment, as if she's going to jump. But if anyone had seen her, had known the whole of her story and everything that had happened in the past few days, well, then of course it would have been obvious that she wasn't going to do that. No one goes through all this just to end a story that way. She isn't the sort who jumps. And then? Then she lets go. The drop is further than you realize, even if you've just been standing up there. It takes longer than you think to hit the surface. A gentle scraping sound, wind seizing hold of paper. The fluttering and crumpling as the letter drifts out across the water. The fingertips that have held that envelope 10,000 times since they first picked it up from the doormat give up their struggle and let the letter sail off toward its own eternity.
The man who sent it to her 10 years ago wrote down everything he thought she needed to know. It was the last thing he ever told anyone. Only 4 words in length, no more than that. The 4 biggest little words one person, anyone at all, can say to another. It wasn't your fault. By the time the letter hits the water, Zara is already walking away toward the far side of the bridge. There's a car parked there, waiting for her. Leonard is sitting inside it. Their eyes meet when she opens the door. He lets her put the music on as loud as she wants. She's planning to do her absolute utmost to get tired of him. Chapter 71. They say that a person's personality is the sum of their experiences. But that isn't true, at least not entirely, because if our past was all that defined us, we'd never be able to put up with ourselves. We need to be allowed to convince ourselves that we're more than the mistakes we made yesterday, that we are all of our next choices, too, all of our tomorrows. The girl always thought that the weirdest thing was that she could never be angry with her mom. The glass surrounding that feeling was impossible to break. After the funeral, she did the cleaning, pulling empty gin bottles from all the hiding places she never had the heart to tell her mom she already knew about. Perhaps that's the last lifeline an addicted parent clings to, the idea that their child probably doesn't know. As if the chaos could possibly be hidden. It can't even be buried, the daughter thought. It just gets handed down. Once, her mom slurred in her ear, "Personality is just the sum of our experiences. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. So don't you worry, my little princess. You won't get your heart broken because you come from a broken home. You won't grow up to be a romantic because children from broken homes don't believe in everlasting love." She fell asleep on her daughter's shoulder on the sofa, and her daughter covered her with a blanket and wiped the spilled gin from the floor. "You're wrong, Mom," she whispered in the darkness. And she was right. No one robs a bank for their children's sake unless they're a romantic. Because the girl grew up and had girls of her own. One monkey, one frog. She tried to be a good mom, even though she didn't have an instruction manual. A good wife, a good employee, a good person. She was terrified of failing every second of every day. But she did genuinely believe that everything was going well for a while. Fairly well, anyway. She relaxed. She wasn't prepared. So infidelity and divorce hit her hard in the back of the head. Life knocked her flat. That happens to most of us at some point. Maybe you, too. A few weeks ago, on the way home from school, the elk and the monkey and the frog all got off the bus as usual and started to walk across the bridge. Halfway across, the girls stopped. Their mom didn't notice at first. And when she looked back, they were 10 yards behind her. The monkey and the frog had bought a padlock. They'd seen people attaching them to the railings of bridges in other towns on the internet.
"If you do that, you lock the love in forever, and then you never stop loving each other."
Their mom felt crushed, because she thought the girls were worried she was going to stop loving them after the divorce. That everything was going to be different now. That she'd stop being theirs. It took 10 minutes of sobbing and confused explanations before the monkey and the frog patiently cupped their mom's cheeks in their hands and whispered,
"We're not worried about losing you, Mom. We just want you to know that you're never going to lose us."
The lock clicked as they fixed it in place. The monkey threw the key over the railing, and it spun down toward the water, and all three of them cried.
"Forever," the mom whispered. "Forever," the girls repeated.
As they were walking away, the youngest daughter admitted that when she first saw that thing about the padlocks online, she thought they were doing it because they were worried someone might steal the bridge. Then she wondered if they might be worried that someone was going to steal the padlock. Her big sister had to explain it to her, but managed to do so without making her little sister feel stupid. Their mom couldn't help thinking that she and their dad had at least gotten something right, because the girls were capable of admitting when they were wrong and of forgiving others when they got things wrong. They had pizza that evening, the girls' favorite. When they'd fallen asleep on their mattresses on the floor of the little apartment that cost $6,500 a month, and which she, at that particular moment, had no idea how she was going to pay the next month's rent on, the mom sat up on her own in the darkness. It wasn't long to Christmas, then it would be New Year. She knew how much the girls were looking forward to the fireworks. It was tearing her apart that they still trusted her, unaware of how many things she'd failed at. When dawn came, she packed their backpacks, and a notebook fell out of her eldest daughter's. She was about to put it back, but it fell open at a page that began with the words, "The Princess with Two Kingdoms." At first, the mom felt annoyed because she had spent their whole lives trying to persuade her daughters not to want to be princesses. She hoped they'd want to be warriors. And because the girls loved their mom, of course they did as she wanted, or at least pretended to, then did the exact opposite, because it's the duty of children not to pay the slightest bit of attention to their parents. The eldest daughter had been told to write a fairy tale of her own for school, so she wrote The Princess with Two Kingdoms. It was about a princess who lived in a big, beautiful castle, and one night the princess found a hole in the floor under her bed, and down inside the hole was a secret, magical world full of strange, fantastical creatures, dragons and trolls and other things her daughter must have thought up herself. Things so fantastical that the imagination and flight from reality that lay behind them crushed the mother, because all she kept thinking was, how terrible must your real life feel to require this much escape? All the creatures were happy, they lived in peace, and there was no pain in their little world. But the princess in the story soon uncovered a terrible truth, that the magical realm she had found, where all her new friends lived, was actually located between two castles in two different kingdoms. One of them was ruled by a king, the other by a queen, and they were fighting a horrible war against each other. They sent their armies to fight and fire terrible weapons, but the walls of both kingdoms were too tall and strong to give way. And in the end, the girl realized that the war wasn't going to destroy either of them. It would just ruin and kill everything that lay between them. And that was when she learned the truth, that the king and queen were her parents. She was their princess, and the entire war was about her. They were each trying to beat the other with the sole aim of winning her back. When the mom read the last words of the story, her daughters were just starting to wake up on their mattresses, and everything that was worth anything inside her shattered. The story ended with the princess saying goodbye to all her new friends and setting off, alone. She disappeared into the darkness one night and never came back again. Because she knew that if she disappeared, there would be nothing left to fight over. That way, she would be able to save both kingdoms and the realm in between. When her daughters had gotten up, the mom had breakfast with them, trying to act as if nothing were wrong. She dropped them off at school, then walked all the way back, out onto the bridge, and stood there in the middle of it, holding on to the padlock as tightly as she could. She didn't fight her ex-husband for her old home. She didn't argue with her former boss about her job. She didn't clash with their lawyer, didn't fire any weapons, didn't cause chaos, for the sake of the children. She did all she could to prevent any of the adults' mistakes from affecting them. That doesn't explain why she tried to rob a bank. It doesn't excuse it. But maybe you've had the occasional really bad idea, too. Maybe you deserved a second chance. Maybe you're not alone in that. On the morning of the day before New Year's Eve, she left home with a pistol. That same evening, right now, she is walking back. A few hours after the hostage drama that the town will be talking about for many, many years to come, the mom picks up her daughters and asks, "Have you had a nice time at Dad's?"
"Yes, Mom, how about you?"
the youngest daughter asks. The mom smiles, thinks for a moment, then shrugs. "Oh, you know, nothing much has happened. Everything's been the same as usual."
But as they cross the bridge, the mom puts one hand gently on her eldest daughter's shoulder and whispers quickly into her ear, "You're my princess and my warrior. You can be both at the same time. Promise me that you'll never forget that." "I know I'm not always such a great mom, but the fact that your dad and I are getting divorced isn't you. You must never think, even for a single second, that this is your..." The eldest daughter nods, blinking away tears. The younger calls to them to hurry up, and they run after her. Their mom wipes her face and asks if they'd like pizza for supper, and the younger one cries out, "Do bears poop in the woods or what?" Just after they fall asleep that night, in their mom's new home, in the apartment of a kind and just crazy enough old lady called Estelle, the eldest daughter takes hold of her mom's hand and whispers, "You're a good mom, Mom. Don't worry so much. It's okay." And there they find it at last. Peace for the realm between the two kingdoms. All the magical, wonderful, made-up creatures can sleep safe and sound. Monkeys, frogs, elks, old ladies, everyone. Chapter 72. The new year arrives, which of course never means as much as you hope, unless you happen to sell calendars. One day becomes another, now becomes then. Winter spreads out across the town like a relative with slightly too much self-confidence. The building on the other side of the road from the bank changes color in line with the temperature. It doesn't look like much, of course. A gray building under its temporary white covering in a place where no one seems to choose to live but merely tolerates being stored. In a few years, no doubt one of the locals will point to the door and tell some smug visitor from one of the big cities, "There was a hostage drama in there once." The visitor will peer at the building and snort, "In there? Yeah, right." Because things like that don't happen in a town like this. Everyone knows that. It's a few days after New Year, and a woman is coming out of the door. She's laughing, her two daughters are with her, and they've just said something that's made them all laugh so hard that their noses are dripping amid the swirling snowflakes. They walk to the trash bin and dispose of a pizza box. Then the woman suddenly looks up and stops mid-stride. One of her daughters starts to climb up her while the other one bounces up and down. It's getting late. The sky is January black, and the falling snow is obscuring visibility, but she sees the police car on the other side of the street. Inside it are an older and a younger police officer. She stares at them. Her daughters haven't noticed her terror yet. All she can think is, not in front of the girls. This takes a matter of seconds, but she manages to live two lifetimes. Theirs. Then the police car rolls slowly toward her. Past her. It drives on, turns right, disappears.
"I'd understand if you want to bring her in," Jim says quietly in the passenger seat, worried that his son's changed his mind.
"No, I just wanted to see her. So there were two of us in this," his son says behind the wheel.
"Two of us in what?"
"Letting her go." They don't say any more about her, either the woman outside the building or the one they both miss. Jim saved a bank robber and deceived his son, and Jack might perhaps never quite be able to forgive him for that. But it's possible for them both to move on together despite that. They drive through their town for several minutes until the father eventually says, without looking at his son,
"I know you've been offered a job in Stockholm."
Jack looks at him in surprise. "How the hell did you hear that?"
"I'm not stupid, you know. Not all the time, anyway. Sometimes I just seem stupid."
Jack smiles shamefacedly. "I know, Dad."
"You ought to take it. The job."
Jack signals, turns, takes plenty of time to come up with a reply. "Take a job in Stockholm? Do you know how much it costs to live there?" His dad taps the plastic door of the glove compartment sadly with his wedding ring.
"Don't stay here for my sake, son."
"I'm not,"
Jack lies. Because he knows that if his mom had been there, she'd have said, "You know what, son? There are worse reasons to stay somewhere."
"Our shift's over," Jim notes.
"Would you like coffee?" Jack asks.
"Now, it's a bit late," his dad yawns.
"Let's stop and get coffee," Jack insists.
"What for?"
"I thought we could pick my car up from the station and go for a drive."
"Where to?"
Jack makes his answer sound obvious. "To see my sister." At that, Jim's eyes lose their focus on his son and slide off toward the road.
"What? Now?"
"Yes."
Why now?"
"It'll soon be her birthday." "It'll soon be your birthday. There are only 11 months to go before Christmas. Does it make any damn difference why? I just thought she might like to come home." Jim has to stay focused on the road, the white line running along the middle of it, to keep his voice under control.
"That's at least a 24-hour drive, though."
Jack rolls his eyes. "What the hell, Dad? I said we'd stop for coffee." So that's what they do. They drive all night and all the following day. Knock on her door. Maybe she'll go home with them. Maybe she won't. Maybe she's ready to find a better way down. Maybe she now knows the difference between how it feels to fly and how it feels to fall. Maybe she doesn't. That sort of thing's impossible to control, just like love. Because perhaps it's true what they say, that up to a certain age, a child loves you unconditionally and uncontrollably for one simple reason. You're theirs. Your parents and siblings can love you for the rest of your life, too, for precisely the same reason. The truth. There isn't any. All we've managed to find out about the boundaries of the universe is that it hasn't got any. And all we know about God is that we don't know anything. So the only thing a mom who was a priest demanded of her family was simple. That we do our best. We plant an apple tree today, even if we know the world is going to be destroyed tomorrow. We save those we can. Chapter 73. Spring arrives. It always finds us in the end. The wind sweeps winter away, the trees rustle and birds start making a fuss, and nature suddenly crashes through with a deafening roar where the snow has swallowed every echo for months. Jack gets out of an elevator, bewildered and curious. He's clutching a letter in his hand. It landed on his doormat one morning without a stamp. Inside was a note with this address on it, as well as the floor of the building and office number. Beneath that was a photograph of the bridge and another envelope, sealed, with another name written on it. Zara saw Jack at the police station and recognized him, in spite of the years that had passed. And because she's been living those same moments over and over again since then, she realized that he's been doing the same. Jack finds the right office, knocks on the door. 10 years have passed since a man jumped, almost exactly the same amount of time since a young woman didn't. She opens the door without knowing who he is, but his heart turns to confetti the moment he sees her, because he hasn't forgotten. He hasn't seen her since she was standing on the railing of the bridge, but he would still have recognized her. Even in darkness.
I,
Jack stammers. "Hello? Are you looking for someone?" Nadia wonders, friendly but bemused. He has to reach out for the doorframe, and her fingertips brush his. They don't yet know how they're capable of affecting each other. He hands her the large envelope with his name written untidily on the front. And inside it are the photograph of the bridge and the address of her office. Beneath those are the smaller envelope with "For Nadia" written on the outside. Inside is a small note on which Zara had written, in considerably neater handwriting, 9 simple words.
"You saved yourself. He just happened to be there."
When Nadia loses her balance just for a moment, Jack catches hold of her arm. Their eyes dance around each other. She clings tightly, tightly, tightly to those 9 words, but barely manages to formulate any of her own.
It was you on the bridge when I... Was that you?
He nods mutely. She fumbles for more words.
I don't know what to... Just give me a moment. I need to compose myself.
She walks to her desk and sinks onto the chair. She's spent 10 years wondering who he was, and now she has no idea what to say, where to start. Jack walks cautiously into the office after her, sees the photograph on the bookcase, the one Zara always adjusted when she was there. It's a picture of Nadia and a group of children at a big summer camp 6 months before. Nadia and the children are laughing and joking, and they're all wearing matching t-shirts bearing the name of the charitable organization that funded the camp. It collects money to work with children like the ones in the picture, all of whom have lost a family member to suicide. It helps to know that you're not alone when you've been left behind. You can't carry the guilt and the shame and the unbearable silence on your own, and you shouldn't have to. That's why Nadia goes to the summer camp each year, to listen a lot, talk a little, and laugh as much as possible. She doesn't know it yet, but the charity has just received a donation to its bank account from a woman with headphones who has resigned from her job, given away her fortune, and crossed a bridge. They'll be able to hold those summer camps for many years to come. Jack and Nadia sit on either side of the narrow desk, looking at each other. He smiles weakly, and after a while she does the same, simultaneously terrified and full of laughter. One day, in 10 years' time, perhaps they'll tell someone that was how it felt. The first time. Chapter 74. The truth? The truth about all this? The truth is that this was a story about many different things, but most of all, about idiots. Because we're doing the best we can, we really are. We're trying to be grown up and love each other and understand how the hell you're supposed to insert USB leads. We're looking for something to cling onto, something to fight for. Something to look forward to. We're doing all we can to teach our children how to swim. We have all of this in common, yet most of us remain strangers. We never know what we do to each other, how your life is affected by mine. Perhaps we hurried past each other in a crowd today, and neither of us noticed, and the fibers of your coat brushed against mine for a single moment, and then we were gone. I don't know who you are. But when you get home this evening, when this day is over and the night takes us, allow yourself a deep breath, because we made it through this day as well. There'll be another one along tomorrow. If you need someone. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Call 800-273-8255. Crisis Text Line. Text TALK to 741-741. For information and support, whether it's you yourself who needs it or someone close to you, take a look at ZeroSuicide.com, SPRC.org.
Anxious People, a novel, was written by Frederick Bachman and read by Marin Ireland. It was recorded by Kathleen Conti at CDM Studios and Kyle Hagland at John Marshall Media. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Anxious People was directed by Michael Noble and Tiffany Ferrari. Produced by Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Anxious People, a novel, is available in print from Atria Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Bear Town by Frederick Bachman, read by Marin Ireland, and A Man Called Uva by Frederick Bachman, read by J.K. Simmons.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.